Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about a really amazing book called The Darjeeling Distinction, Labour and Justice on Fair Trade Tea Plantations in India by Sarah Besky. The book is published by University of California Press, and Sarah is Assistant Professor in the Department of Anthropology in the School of Natural Resources and Environment and a Postdoctoral Fellow in the Michigan Society of Fellows in the University of Michigan. The book is an amazing book. I really loved reading it. It's one of those ethnographies that really draws you in. And as you might have guessed from the title, it's about tea pickers in and around Darjeeling in the northeast of India. I had the pleasure of talking with Sarah just a few minutes before. So without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Sarah to the show. Thanks a lot for your wonderful book and thanks a lot for coming on.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. So before we start talking about the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became interested in this topic and what your background is?
Sure. So I'm a cultural anthropologist. I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Anthropology. And right now I'm at the University of Michigan in both anthropology and the School for Natural Resources and Environment, as well as the Society of Fellows. So as a cultural anthropologist, kind of really most broadly, I'm interested in the intersections between nature and capitalism and labor. And so, you know, that translates into, you know, how I do my work or how I think about my work and kind of thinking about the stories of stuff, right? The, you know, thinking about the things we use in our everyday lives and really the labor practices and the environmental conditions and all of the kind of the background of this stuff. So we can call it kind of critical capitalism studies. I kind of like to think about it as stuff stories. And tea in particular is particularly interesting to me. Again, in the United States, we know a lot about coffee, right? And coffee is kind of part of kind of the national consciousness, right? A lot of my colleagues who work in agriculture and labor, right, have their own histories as solidarity workers in Central America, you know, working to break the coffee embargo in Nicaragua and whatnot, right? Coffee has this place in the national imaginary. But we know so little about tea, right? Tea is this kind of undifferentiated commodity, right? Even when I go to the coffee shop around the corner from my office and, I can pick from all sorts of geographical regions of coffee, but I can't for tea. So it kind of brings some critical attention to tea as a thing and as a place and as a product.
Excellent. Thanks for that. Now, we're going to start to talk about the book itself a little more, and you're going to talk about Darjeeling, and we're going to discuss about, and about many different aspects of this. But before we go into that, I was wondering if you could tell us what made you want to write this book in particular, and also how you went about doing it.
Sure. The book is, ask questions about fair trade, right? And social justice and agriculture. And, you know, and fair trade is thought to be something that is just like holy and like undeniably good, right? And, the book is a story about fair trade, but it's not my intent to kind of rail on or trash the fair trade project, but to bring critical attention to it. And the first way I kind of do that is to bring attention to the plantation and its place within the fair trade system. Again, in fair trade, we think mostly about kind of Latin American coffee cooperatives, right? You know, small farmers, right? Solidarity struggles, histories of revolution. We don't think about post-colonial contexts, and we don't think about plantations. So what I, you know, what I want to do with the book, what I and why I wanted to, you know, write it was to historicize fair trade and to historicize the plantation within kind of agricultural development, really, really generally. And in doing that, as an anthropologist, again, as a cultural anthropologist, I want to situate fair trade within kind of a larger social field. And so, you know, that's, again, that's what kind of makes this uniquely anthropological compared to other kind of fair trade studies. And in that larger field, you know, I want to, you know, kind of look at this very marginal and kind of out of the way place, right? Darjeeling kind of sits on the borders of India, right? So not only is the plantation marginal in fair trade, right? Like Darjeeling is marginal within kind of plantation production, right? It sits, you know, very, you know, in this kind of at the margins of South Asia, right? And so for South Asian studies to bring attention to India's margins, to bring attention to the Nepali, a Nepali diaspora, Indian Nepalis within India, to kind of get out of the, you know, the heartland, and look at kind of colonial and post-colonial histories at the border, as well as how, you know, the plantation and fair trade and these kind of new international certification schemes are wrapped up in larger processes of environmental change, as well as, you know, subnational politics, which we'll talk more about.
Mm-hmm. And how did you go about getting the data for the book?
Oh, sure. So most my method is, you know, mostly participant observation, right? So I, on plantations, you know, I followed workers and I plucked tea, you know, all day with workers. I drank tea on Sundays, the day off on plantations. I went, you know, and I went down and I did laundry and held babies and went to weddings and funerals and kind of just lived and try to, you know, kind of, you know, just kind of be with kind of the rhythms of everyday life, right? And so that was on the plantation. But in addition to kind of a plantation ethnography through participant observation, I, in Darjeeling town, kind of high up on the ridge, the plantations are all kind of below town. In town, I went to political rallies and union meetings. Darjeeling is kind of the site of a subnational agitation to create a separate state of Gorkhaland, right? Indian Nepalis are referred to, or call themselves Gorkhas, right? So Gorkhaland is the name of that state. So I went to Gorkhaland rallies and talked to politicians, right, about the Gorkhaland project, but also about the place of the plantation within this vision of a separate state.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And the richness of this, of the data that comes out of your ethnographic method is really there for readers in the book. There's some wonderful anecdotes, which I don't know whether we'll get to talk about. I suppose they're the things which are best read, which I'd really want to flag up for listeners at home. Now, you mentioned two things already. One was this Gorkha movement for an independent state, and the other one was fair trade certification. And I suppose the other big theme in the book is a geographical indication, which is the exclusive right of tea producers in Darjeeling to call their tea Darjeeling tea. And these are the sort of three themes that we're going to explore and that come up in three of the more substantive chapters. But before we do that, let's talk about a few of the theories or a few of the concepts which you delineate in the introduction, and this will help us sort of situate your work within sort of academic debates that are going on. So I think there's three important things which come up in your introduction. One is the concept of justice. One is this what you call the tripartite moral economy, and the other is this third world agrarian imagination. So first of all, Azuni, can tell us, how do you use the concept of justice?
Sure. So justice is like a really elusive concept, and I think that's why it's so interesting to me. We, you know, each of us probably in our everyday lives, we kind of throw it around, but we also qualify it a lot, right? We talk about environmental justice, we talk about food justice or transitional justice. And in anthropology, we have a really, really rich and developed kind of sub-discipline or sub, you know, kind of specialization about the kind of the anthropology of law, right? Which is explicitly about justice, right? But in writing this book, I kind of wanted to look outside of, you know, proper juridical justice. And I was really interested in how justice as a concept is thought of often or used as kind of as this kind of thing that means on its own, right? A natural concept, a universalized concept, right? And that's where kind of anthropologists, you know, can step in because, right, we know that nothing means on its own, right? People kind of give things meaning. And so I wanted to bring attention to the relationship, conceptual relationship between justice and injustice, right? Because how we frame or how we define injustice, right, has, you know, direct implications for what we mean when we say justice, right? And, it can, and really it's about, you know, it's about context. And justice is a really kind of a futuristic kind of concept, right? If we think about it that way, if justice is this, it exists in this dialectical relationship to injustice, right? It's about justice is about an idea for cultural change, right? Because it's if we don't talk about justice as a state we have now, we talk about it as a state we want to see. So specifically in the book, I look at how different actors define justice and frame that transcendence, frame that cultural change from the perceived state of injustice and how it's defined. And to kind of look at these tensions and to look at these different formulations of justice, but in one place, right, on Darjeeling plantations, on Darjeeling fair trade plantations, and how one site can be, this kind of place that brings together different visions of justice and different articulations of injustice. So to kind of look at these ideas in tension, as always, made by people too.
And how does your idea of the tripartite moral economy fit into this?
Sure. So the classic kind of moral economy and, you know, social sciences, right, is between landholders and peasants, or between, you know, kind of the powerful and the powerless. And, you know, my work kind of builds on that classic kind of binary framework, but it brings attention to kind of actual material or environmental relationships, right, as well. So on the plantation, right, the tripartite moral economy, as I'm calling it, is between between labor, management, right, those binary relationships, as well as the agroenvironment, which includes, you know, actual tea bushes and forests and soils and kind of that, again, that ecological environmental material context. So, you know, again, the binary moral economy looks at reciprocal relationships between landholders and peasants or tenant farmers. I'm looking at the reciprocal relationships not only between labor and management, but between, say, management and bushes, or between labor and bushes, right? So thinking about these three-way reciprocal relationships. And right, to in the tripartite moral economy as a concept, right, I want to use it to bring attention to the fact that the ecological context, right, the material context, like where we are in the world, is something that makes a difference for, right, for understanding not only development interventions, right, but what justice might itself mean.
Wonderful. And then so the third sort of big concept that we need to understand is the third world agrarian imagination.
Right. And so my idea of the third world agrarian imaginary really builds upon geographer Julie Guthman's formulation of an agrarian imaginary. And she's talking specifically about U.S. organic agriculture. And she's talking about the fact that, you know, within, you know, frameworks, you know, or understandings or popular, visions of U.S. organic agriculture, right, labor is completely invisible, right? Field labor is completely invisible. What we think of when we think about organic agriculture is kind of this morally righteous family farm, right? This individual or kind of family that farms their own land and has these, you know, particular connections, moral redemptive relationships with that land, right? There is no labor, right? The farmer himself or herself, right, works the land and has this relationship to it. But when I try to kind of think about that, you know, really important framework for understanding, alternative agriculture, where I work, right, up in India, in a post-colonial context, in the margins of India, I kind of have trouble applying it, because labor really is like too visible to be ignored, right, on the plantation, right? And in fact, right, fetishized, essentialized visions of labor, particularly of female labor, is part of the value of the thing itself, right? Like, so the icon, right, the label for Darjeeling tea, right? You may, if you pick up a box of Darjeeling tea, you may see that, right? It says it's a woman in profile, kind of head tipped with a head basket holding a tea leaf, right? Like, that vision of labor, right, is inseparable from the thing itself. So but it's a vision that is historically decontextualized, right? The plantation is severed, right, in these kind of popular, you know, visions from a colonial history, from an oppressive colonial history, from histories of indenture and marginalization and landscape transformation, and really the fact that today, even today, right, a plantation, right, is a system in which laborers are, I mean, not necessarily bonded in the same way they were in the 1830s, but tied in a not quite free market system in which jobs are inherited, right? They're passed between kin lines. There is no free market for labor, right? The idea that you can kind of come and go from work as if it was, you know, just some kind of factory anywhere it doesn't kind of hold up. Right. So the third little gray and imaginary, you know, brings attention to these dehistoricized images and dehistoricized understandings of labor and the environment and brings kind of analytical attention to that separation and tries to understand how labor itself becomes consumable in the global south in alternative or just agricultural products from the global south.
Great, great. And now we have a perfect opportunity to historicize. So let's find out a little bit more about then Darjeeling. I mean, I imagine most people, including myself, know it has some colonial past. Know it has have in their mind some sort of misty mountain sort of image in their mind, but that's pretty much about it. But it has a fascinating history, as you detail. So give us some of those details.
Right. So exactly. As you point out, like Darjeeling is this town high up on the ridge in the Himalayan foothills of northeastern India. But as a place, right, as a town, it's a remarkable kind of colonial invention. It was identified by British Army officers in the early 1800s as kind of this ideal location for a sanatorium for their convalescing peers, right, suffering, plagued by, right, heat and disease in the plains. Right, this kind of cool, misty complement to the plains was part of why Darjeeling itself was kind of thought of as a valuable potential resting place. And by the 1830s, right, this vision, right, had become a reality, had become actualized. And the town, right, high up on that ridge, was developed into a burgeoning hill station, right, kind of one of these places where British colonial officers and colonial kind of offices even really decamped for the hot monsoon months, right, the disease-ridden months. And, you know, in the hill station, right, we see schools and whole families, right, kind of resettle up to the mountains, right? So Darjeeling was a place not only for kind of colonial servants, but for their wives and children, right? So there's, you know, the kind of these famous boarding schools, right, up in town as well as beautiful veranda bungalows and iron gates and iron fencing and kind of all of the trappings of this kind of out, you know, this very kind of British feeling place, right? And it was a place that was kind of made in the vision of recuperative ideals of nature, right? And so, but that's town, right? And that's kind of the vision of the landscape you see from town, right, up on the ridge. And as I mentioned before, if you look below town, right, if you look down into the valleys, you see these green hillsides, right, these sweeping valleys of greenness, right? And that greenness is tea. And really, you know, it's a really striking landscape. But when you kind of get up close, it's only then you kind of realize it as a plantation. Right. And shortly after Darjeeling, Darjeeling's development as a hill station, right, as this place of convalescence, British civil servants began testing various crops up in the mountains to see if they were, you know, exploitable up there, including tea. And it became, tea tested well up in those misty foothills, particularly, right, the Chinese variety of tea. And there's two jots or, you know, varieties of tea bush, right, that are prominent. There's the Chinese variety, which has kind of coarser, smaller, denser leaves that kind of make a lighter finer brew, if you will. And the indigenous Assam variety of tea, which is the bushes kind of have these bigger, glossier leaves, and the tea is kind of a little bit more tannic, a little blacker, a little bit more pungent. So Darjeeling was a great place to grow that Chinese variety of tea up in the high altitudes, right? So the place was kind of light and refined, and the tea was also in a way kind of light and refined. So there's kind of this convergence of place and product in Darjeeling that we see kind of in the late 1800s, because Darjeeling was kind of thought of as a product, kind of the first tea to be as good as Chinese tea. And after independence in 1947, we kind of see a decline in the industry as British capital kind of left the region, plantations closed, and this kind of market for Darjeeling tea started to dwindle a little bit. And it's really only been in recent years, you know, with the introduction of fair trade and organic and kind of other alternative agricultural projects and tourism, really, that we see and actually a revived or maybe a newly, you know, thinking about tea as this healthy beverage, right? People kind of, you know, desiring tea as a thing, right? Darjeeling has seen a resurgence as a product. But still, like, people, you know, come to Darjeeling as to kind of experience that misty mountain recuperative environment as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it wasn't an intention when you wrote the chapter. This is, you're talking here about chapter one, but when I was reading it, I was thinking this would make a wonderful tourist guide as well from one tourist, because you situate all of these histories within the actual landscape of Darjeeling now with the bandstand, etc., and so on. But yeah, that's, I'm sure that wasn't there. wasn't your intention. Now, anyway, let's talk about what you talk about in chapter two. You talk about the rise of what you call business practices on the plantation. So I was wondering if you can tell us what these practices are and how they relate to the ideas of justice.
Sure. And so in Darjeeling, when I was talking to tea workers, I was constantly struck by this dynamic or this between industry and business, and right. And Nepali workers, Nepali is the lingua franca of Darjeeling, you know, on the plantations, workers, you know, interspersed industry and business as English words in their discussions, right. And in their critiques, and business, is kind of a catch-all term for kind of contemporary, quote-unquote, neoliberal practices of kind of extracting as much out of labor and nature as humanly possible, right? And whereas industry is this kind of almost nostalgic vision of the past in which, you know, kind of a colonial vision in which workers, you know, describe the plantation as kind of more, you know, symbiotically kind of running, right? Those tripartite moral relationships, moral economic relationships were thought to be, you know, upheld at every stage, right? And planters, right, plantation managers and plantation owners were thought to be better human beings and better stewards of the land, right? If someone needed an advance on their pay or someone needed shoes, right, those owners would provide for that. But in business, right, and so this whole chapter is kind of about kind of an articulating business. I give the example of the age of tea bushes, so like actual tea bushes. And so what's interesting about a tea bush is that it actually has about the kind of productive life of a human being, right? So like, you know, once it gets to be about 70 or so years old, right, it's not as productive as it once was. And workers are kind of really keenly aware of that. And they talk about new young bushes as children, as ungendered children. But when they become like upwards of 80 and, you know, 100 and 150 years old, in the case of some bushes in Darjeeling, right, they're what's called, you know, buro, right, old, right? Like, and buro is this beautiful word that you know, as a woman worker would call her kind of her old man, her husband, like as an old man, right, to kind of index, right, his, you know, his laziness or his, you know, uselessness, you know, around the house or something, right? You know, an old man. So it's kind of a really interesting word, right? And so workers, you know, talk about that instead of replanting those buro bushes, right, those old bushes, they just would kind of let them go and let them continually be more unproductive. But management decided to plant in marginal areas of the plantation, right, on the forest edges of the plantation or in landslide-prone areas where there's kind of natural water drainage because, right, these are kind of alpine slopes. And that's, that was, you know, described to me as a biz, as like a proper, as like a total, like a great example of a business practice, right? Because an industry, you know, person, right, a planter in the industry period would have replanted those old bushes in the sections of the plantation. A business businessman planter, right, extracted, you know, cut down forest and planted new bushes instead of, you know, instead of replanting old bushes, right? When that, and that was, you know, not only a business practice, but that was a violation of a moral economic relationship, right, between not only workers and management, right, between management and the bushes, right? They had an obligation to to allocate capital to replant those bushes.
And this sort of shift in practice, this is a common theme which runs throughout all of the remaining chapters, I suppose. But let's talk now a little bit what you talk about in the third chapter. You explore geographical indication in more detail. There's a beautiful advert that you show where Darjeeling tea is compared to champagne and cognac. And I was wondering if you can tell us, in what ways are these similar, and how this how does geographical indication bring these things together? Where does it come from, this idea, and how does it play out in plantation labor?
So GI, or geographical indication, right, is this, you know, essentially like this legal, like, you know, designation that Darjeeling shares with cognac and champagne, right, as you pointed out, but also kind of, you know, umpteen number of cheeses and French wines and, right, all of these kind of things that have, you know, kind of that are thought of as supposed to be being from a place, right? And by virtue of being a geographical indication, it means that that thing, whether it's Darjeeling tea or champagne or cognac, has to be produced in that place, right? You can't call tea grown in Sri Lanka that just happens to approximate the taste of Darjeeling, say, for example, Darjeeling. It has to be grown in Darjeeling, right? And there's pretty soft, ability to kind of control for this, right? It's done through bilateral kind of agreements, right? There's not necessarily a GI police that kind of follows up on this, right? So it's a very idealized kind of system. But what's interesting about GI products, right, whether it's cognac or champagne or Bordeaux, is that they're thought of as these craft products, right, and much more in line with Guthman's understanding of the agrarian imaginary, right, that individual farmer, right, that morally righteous, you know, craftsman, right, artisan that has some sort of connection to the thing that they're producing and has this kind of historical, right, almost kind of timeless relationship to the thing that they produce, right, that this knowledge has been passed on, it's traditional, right, it's passed on from generation to generation, right, that's kind of what we think about as GIs, and that's actually kind of one of the kind of things you have to prove to become a GI, right, that it is the product of traditional knowledge. So like my question in the book is like, so how can Darjeeling tea, right, which is this 100% plantation product, pretty new, like, I mean, 1850s, right, sit next to these seemingly traditional products that are produced through artisan, you know, artisan labor, right, and not through, you know, marginalized plantation labor. And the answer kind of comes back to that third world agrarian imaginary, right? It comes, the plantation laborers, right, those individuals who are just too, you know, visible to be ignored, had to become those artisans, right? And so what's really fascinating in GI kind of representations of Darjeeling, right, the plantation management is actually quite absent, right? It's plantation workers who are kind of the prime movers of this agricultural system, right? And they have these timeless you know, relationships to tea bushes, right? You know, day in and day out, you know, the remarkable kind of advertisements about how the touch of their hands gives the brew its sweetness, and that, you know, they live in this idyllic existence, right, close to nature's heartbeat. And the chapter kind of really, you know, is a content analysis of a lot of these advertisements to kind of look at how labor itself becomes not only productive of the terroir, right, of the taste of place of Darjeeling, but itself becomes part of that taste itself, right, that the women's hands are part of the taste of the tea. So it's just kind of, yeah, so we kind of understand, like, just the chapter kind of just looks at how Darjeeling tea, how a plantation crop, right, came to be thought of as something, right, that could be, you know, could sit alongside champagne or cognac unproblematically, right? That image is kind of is what I want to unpack.
Mm-hmm. And I think another sort of comfortable yet uncomfortable when I started to think about it when I read your book is this sitting next to these two concepts next to each other of fair trade and plantation, because they don't sit very well together in our Western imagination at all. I mean, if we think of plantation, of course, outside of tea, we have all these images of slavery and or bonded labor, etc., and so on. And but here we have fair trade plantations. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the rise of fair trade, how it came to Darjeeling, and what this means for the plantation laborers themselves.
Right. So, I mean, you point out, I mean, that great paradox, right? Like, so when we think about fair trade and we think about small farmers, we think about kind of revolutionary struggles, we certainly don't think about plantations, right? And so fair trade, is a market relationship. So like, I mean, in terms of like any kind of fair trade, and it kind of exists around two kind of numbers, right? So the first is fair trade prices, right? Fair trade minimum prices, right? Which is this idea that a fair trade product, right? A retailer for buying a fair trade product is supposed to pay a fixed rate, not the market rate for a given pound of coffee or a given kilo of tea. It's a fixed rate, ideally higher than the market rate for a given product. And those numbers are kind of set, regularly by Fair Trade International and fair trade bodies. And the second is fair trade premiums, right? Which is, again, these kind of numbers are mediated by these international fair trade groups. But, you know, what we think of, I mean, from consumers that I talk to, right, we think about the fair trade premium is this, you know, this little extra bit that we are agreeing to pay as consumers, right, that's come out of somehow kind of attached to the product that goes directly to producers. Where the major difference in fair trade on cooperatives to fair trade on plantations rests in, the kind of distribution and mediation of that fair trade premium. On cooperatives, cooperatives have the ability to divvy it up and do with it what they see fit. On plantations, that premium, right, the kind of collected premiums for all the fair trade tea sold, goes into the bank account for what is called a joint body. And the joint in joint body means that management and workers jointly decide how to spend that money. So if you can kind of put yourself in a room as if you're a tea laborer, and you know you're making a dollar a day, and you know that, and you're sitting, you know, with your plantation management and your plantation owner in the same room, and he asks you what you think you're supposed to, you know, what you should do with that money. How much kind of agency, how much kind of power you have to really voice your actual opinion, is quite suspect. But that's kind of this idea that fair trade on plantations kind of rests on, right? This idea that workers and management, kind of in this kind of benevolent kind of relationship, right, decide how to manage the plantation together. It's a very kind of idyllic vision of the plantation. And in my experience, right, the joint bodies were really unsuccessful and often didn't meet at all. And again, just to go back to this like oxymoronic kind of quality of fair trade plantation, right? Fair trade discourse and practice in all of their marketing materials does everything that it can really to kind of take our attention away from the fact that these land tenure rate arrangements are plantations, right? They call them estates, or more importantly, they call them gardens, right? A garden, right? How can that be that's kind of this apolitical notion of what a plantation might be, right? They never, ever, ever call them plantations, right? They're happy to call cooperatives, but they will never call a plantation, right? So discursively, fair trade moves us away from thinking about the kind of historical, the past, right? The problem of the relationships of indenture and whatnot that go into the plantation, right? And really, kind of what I want to kind of make you sit with as a reader is to kind of think about how fair trade is a market solution to a problem caused by the market, and how successful can kind of, right, something be, right, that kind of uses the problem to solve uses the problem as part of the solution, right? If capitalism is the problem, is more capitalism the solution, right? So to think about the basic premise of fair trade.
One of the nice things about living in Eastern Europe is I don't feel guilty when I go to the supermarket because there's no fair trade products. So I don't buy them. Now, we talked about two types of justice here, and you're already hinting about the sort of these failures and the failures to address some of the underlying problems. But there's a third type which actually struck me when I first read your introduction and I realized that this was coming as a chapter. The third type of justice movement you discuss in your book is that for the demand of Gorkhaland. This is a autonomous Nepali state within India, and I was just wondering, and this is the question I had before I read the chapter, and I'm sure a lot of people at home are thinking this, like, how does this relate to tea?
Right. And so I put, fair trade and GI alongside of Gorkhaland to kind of bring attention to how even in Darjeeling, right, the politicians, right, these town-based politicians like GI and Gorkhaland really, have no, concrete vision for how a plantation might actually change, right? Their vision, like the Gorkhaland vision of justice, is as abstract and as really meaningless to workers as GI and fair trade, right? They're as disconnected to it. But specifically, right, Gorkhaland is the movement to kind of break off Darjeeling and its tea producing regions, and it's kind of the adjacent region of the Dwars, which kind of sits in the state of West Bengal to the north, to break off that kind of northern part of North Bengal into its own state, right? A separate Indian state, right? Not a separate country. And the reason for this, right, is that everyone I talk to, whether they work on a plantation or not, in Darjeeling feels that as Indian Nepalese, right, they are not considered full citizens by kind of other Indians, right? When they travel, say, to Calcutta or Delhi or even down to Siliguri, right, they're thought of as not Indian, or they're marginalized, or they're kind of racialized, or they're made fun of for not really being one of us, right? And so the idea behind a separate state, right, the foundational idea behind a separate state, is that by being an Indian state, they would be considered, right, part of the Indian nation, right? They would have this kind of place within the nation that they do not have now. And that is evocative to both, plantation workers and townspeople. This idea that But the Gorkhaland project really isn't going to change anything about the land tenure system on plantations, right? Nothing really is going to concretely change with Gorkhaland. And I talked to high up political officials in the separatist party, and I asked them, like, so with Gorkhaland, what would change on the plantation? And it's just like, well, nothing, right? The owners will still be the owners, the workers will still be the workers. But, like, it'll be in Gorkhaland, right? This idea that there's actually a stratigraphy of land, right? That there's stuff, like the stuff on top of the land, right? The factories, the bushes, right? That's, right, that can be the owners, right? And that can be owned and that by a non-Nepali plantation owner, and that's fine. But, like, the stuff under that, right? The stuff, like, deep beneath the actual material soil, right? This meta land, right? That would be Gorkha. Right. And that's what's really, that's what's important to workers. Right. When I ask them, what Gorkhaland might mean to them. Right. And, in a monetary sense. Right. That, these plantation owners, right, these non-Nepali plantation owners would need to pay taxes to Gorkhas, and right, by paying taxes would need to kind of acknowledge the fact that, Gorkhas are citizens, right? Are Indians, are people with, political clout. And that's what's important. But I mean, in terms of, what Gorkhaland could do, put alongside the questions of what GI could do and what fair trade could do in terms of, a project for justice. The answer is, again, really, really little. Because, and workers are kind of really well aware of that, right? They know that the plantation's really not going to reform. So it's kind of, I wanted there to be kind of more of a sense of transcendence, right? Just for my own kind of, political sense, right? That there would be some sort of change, right? But workers, tempered my own dreams and expectations, right? I'd be like, it's not going to change that much.
maybe a little bit of an unfair question. Do you think it will happen, an independent state?
I think it's in the realm of possibility. It would be wonderful. I mean, right now, there are states that are breaking off and forming smaller separate states, Telangana, Uttarakhand, Jharkhand, right? And Gorkhas are well aware of that. And kind of right now with the political kind of, situation nationally, in favor of separate states or smaller states, who knows, right? Who knows?
Yeah, so that's just came into my mind, and I thought that, as you have been dealing a lot with the issue. So, I just wanted to flag up to listeners as well that this is probably the best book we've had on the show in terms of the chapters titles. Each chapter title just has one word: Darjeeling, plantation, property, fairness, sovereignty. So you really know what you're getting. It's really, really punchy. And that and they're the sort of five chapters we've shot through. And then there's a conclusion. And in conclusion, you ask yourself a question: is something better than nothing? So that's a question I'll ask to you now. Is something better than nothing?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's a question I heard all the time, or more framed as a statement, right? Because it was when I would bring up, critical points about fair trade or GI or Gorkhaland, right? I was often kind of met with the statement, well, something is better than nothing, right? In the case of fair trade, that, fair trade premiums are going to build latrines or going to fix a road that the owner is supposed to do himself, right? Something is better than nothing. At least it's getting built. And I was just kind of deeply unsatisfied with that, because I was just like, well, no, something is not better than nothing. And even just saying that something is better than nothing it's kind of like the relationship between justice and injustice, right? Saying that something is better than nothing, making your intervention that something means framing a suitable nothing, means making your something the answer to the nothing, right? And something does not replace nothing. Something replaces another something, right? There is something there. And that's what I kind of want to bring attention to in the book, right? So I'm not answering the question at all. and I don't answer the question in the book. But the conclusion really is to just voice my own dissatisfaction with development interventions or various agricultural projects that use that rhetoric or use that, that logic, right? Because it's like, no, there's not nothing there. There is something, right? In the case of plantations, right, there's this elaborate plantations labor law that, if it were to be followed, would make a huge difference in the everyday lives of plantation laborers. And laborers know that, right? So, like, why are we looking at fair trade that doesn't actually even work when we have a system that works? Like, maybe I would like to call for fair traders to, look at labor law and maybe hold plantations first and foremost accountable to the laws that exist before they kind of institute their own abstract standards. So that's what I wanted. That's what that question does. Mm-hmm. And so maybe the answer in terms of yes or no is like, just to say no, like, no, something is not better than nothing, because that's not a question that I want to be asked. And I think that it should be asked.
Thanks. Now, we've really shot through what is a really, what is a really rich book. So I was wondering if there's anything you want to flag up that I've missed with my questions.
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay, that's good. And sorry to give you two awkward questions in a row then. I just want to say for the listeners at home that I really, really enjoyed this book. It's really, really readable. I read most of this book at strange times of the night, soothing a newborn child, and it's very immersive. You can really get into it and really get into the lives of the people whose stories it tells as well. And I want to recommend it not just for people interested in, anthropology of labor or these, or even with the specific questions or South Asian studies, because it's a very readable book and very enjoyable. So I'd like to recommend it to everyone at home for that reason. But now you've finished this book's out, and I guess you're probably working on new projects. So I don't know if you want to tell us anything that you're working on now.
Sure. So I have two new projects that I'm working on. One is about tea, one is not. I'm working on a new book on really broadly on commodities auctions, but really I'm using the tea auction. And so tea in India and elsewhere is auctioned, right? It's not a futures market like coffee or petroleum or non-fat dried milk or and these other commodities that we may use. It's auctioned, right? In these live auctions, right? Which until only very recently were live and done by individuals who had tasted that lot of tea and auctioned it at the same time. But now we have this we see this instituting of a computerized system for the selling of and valuing of tea. And so my new book kind of just looks at the move of expertise, right? The construction of colonial expertise around taste and how that's changing. With this computerized system, right? So using the auction as the kind of central space, but kind of asking questions about taste and connoisseurship and technology and gender, right? I mean, because these tasters are all men, right? And generally computer experts are all men. So maybe from this, change from, colonial kind of tasting practice to computerized tasting practice, like what's really changing? Because like one middle-class male subject is replacing another middle-class male subject. So that's that project kind of really in a nutshell. And then I'm just, you kind of pointed out the chapter one is kind of this landscape story of my, the Darjeeling Distinction book. And I had so much fun writing that chapter, that I'm kind of, I really want to do, a book, and I'm working on a new project on that's kind of much more of a natural history of Darjeeling that kind of looks at the issue of belonging, but not just from a human perspective. It's kind of, each chapter kind of takes a different kind of plant or thing, right, or animal, right? So it looks at, certain kinds of softwood timber and stray dogs and macaque monkeys and red pandas and kind of reads the kind of natural history of Darjeeling, reads belonging kind of through these different kind of beings.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Both those projects sound fascinating. I want to read about the stray dogs. I think I spent any time in India is always fascinated by them. Okay, well, just nothing more to say apart from thanks a lot for coming on the show and thanks a lot for your wonderful book.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Okay, it's wonderful. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Today we've been talking about The Darjeeling Distinction by Sarah Besky, a brilliant book that I'd strongly recommend. Thanks a lot for listening. Ta-ra!